Welcome to Writing and Publishing with Dumbold Bob. Thanks for joining us for this episode. Let's get started. In this episode of Writing and Publishing with Dumbold Bob, we're going to take a look at the world of publishing. Specifically, we're going to talk about traditional publishing and self-publishing, and in some ways, different aspects about publishing in general. I need to stress, this is going to be something of a different presentation of information. I'm going to try and stay faithful to the tried and true ideas, but I want to start getting you to think about different parts of the process. I want you to begin thinking a bit more about elements you may not have considered previously. You don't need me to say traditional publishing is paid for by the publishing house and self-publishing is paid for by the author as a generalization. I'm going to do just that, but you don't need me to. What I am going to do is ask you to consider what you need from the process. What are your strengths and where do you need help? It's these other ideas, the hidden things, that are going to help you figure out the best approach and travel plans for your journey. So we're going to explore just a little bit more from just a bit of a different viewpoint. We're going to start with two stories. I'm presenting them because one of the things that's important to recognize is just how differently people view the situations, conditions, and decisions that are out there in the publishing world. What may seem obvious to you may mean something wildly different to someone else. Something I may have decided could be cast in a totally new light with just a small bit of additional information. From there, we'll shift back to the publishing world and examine those two widespread categories of traditional and self by going back a few years, actually a few decades, to set up something of a where-it-all-began baseline that we'll set off from and then follow the path to today. One important idea to share as we begin. I tend to speak in a casual way. I already know there will be moments where I do things like using terms such as writer and author as if they mean the same thing. Some folks aren't too concerned if you swap them around and use them as if they're interchangeable. Some folks are rigid in their belief that they are significantly different words. Both groups of people are right and justified in their thoughts. I need you to think of us as sitting in a room and having a conversation. Relaxed, friendly, and exchanging ideas. Don't get too wound up in my mentioning something like a newspaper and race off to wondering whether or not newspapers are dated and disappearing, or trying to decide if I mean a print edition, a subscription service, an online website, or something delivered to your smartphone or tablet using an app. Enjoy the conversation, and context will pretty much always clarify where I'm going with an idea. That way, we should usually arrive on the same page. And if not, reach out, send me a message or an email, and we can discuss it. Off we go. As the first real segment of this episode, I want to offer two stories, because somewhere we are going to reach a point where things begin to blur a bit for you. One of the major differences between traditional publishing and self-publishing is how they have transformed and changed, especially in recent years and with reactions to technology. As a result, I think it's important to note that not all authors have the same feelings about, responses to, or needs from the industry. Both of these stories come from the same event. Roughly 8 or 9 years ago, I was at a library's author day. Most of us have a general idea about events like readings or signings. I think we can also imagine a panel discussion featuring a few different speakers. Several libraries have days where they invite authors to attend. Usually they feature local writers and provide an opportunity to network with people, promote work, and make some sales. It's a bit different than what you might consider the normal appearance. We'll talk more about these types of events in a separate episode, but it's something important to note for a couple of things. First, while some of them do provide strong sales for authors, the vast majority of author days do not. Second, Don't let that scare you away from them, since they offer an incredible opportunity to meet people. On more than one occasion, I have gone to an author showcase day and left with as many books as I arrived with. Not a single sale. And yet, I got to meet people at the library in person instead of through emails and phone calls. Often, they're attended by folks from bookstores, and people stopping to chat for a few moments may not be ready to purchase something immediately, but you can hand them a business card or a flyer. These types of events may not generate immediate sales. They have increased the network of people I know, though, with many great friendships developing from them. They have created future events at libraries and shops for me. And they have led to sales down the road, when folks that I had a chance to speak with for just a few moments got home, looked over the materials I handed them, and then sought out my work online. The reason I want to start with these stories is that I'd like you to consider what you believe book publishing is all about. What does it mean when we say a book has been published? Also, when thinking about your situation, do you thoroughly review your situation? Do you know your market? Do you know where you'll be selling your book and who'll be buying copies? While maybe not immediately in your thoughts when I bring up traditional and self-publishing, we need to realize not everyone is viewing the landscape with the same needs or beliefs. On this particular day, each author was given their own table. I was along a wall with a table on my right and another on my left. These stories involve the people at those two tables. The first story involves the man to my left. What immediately raised a question in my head was that if I say the word book to you, what he had on his table likely wouldn't be the first thing you have in mind. He had several three-ring binders on display. Turned out, he considered these binders to be collector's editions of his work. What he had done was print his manuscript on three-hole paper and placed it within the binder. He used the binders that allowed for inserts and slipped pages in with images to represent the front and back covers and the spine of the book. While he didn't sell any copies that day, we had a chance to discuss these books quite a bit. He would sign them for those buying a copy and include a date and number with the personalization. He then logged each one for his records. The signs he set up and the materials he handed out referred to these books as commemorative and limited edition. Our second story comes from the table to my right and a woman selling children's books and gift baskets. Have you ever attended a craft show, seasonal festival, or holiday bazaar? If so, then you know about the vendors that often attend. What you may not know is that many of those events have requirements about what you can offer for sale as a vendor. She often went to these events to sell jewelry. One annual show she wanted to be a part of would allow her to sell jewelry, but there was a requirement that at least one item for sale from any vendor must qualify as a handmade item by their definitions or rules. Their list of items allowed for writers to sell their books and consider them handmade. In order to meet the show's restrictions, she wrote a short story, went to a nearby printer, and ordered 100 copies of the book. They cost her about $2 each to print. She then sold them for $5 each, expecting them to maybe sell a bit here and there, but more importantly, allowing her to be at the event and present her more serious endeavors with the jewelry. What she didn't anticipate was what the books would do for her business overall. Children are often bored at these types of events. Most tables and vendors, they simply aren't selling items that appeal to them. The books were different, and the kids spotted them. That led several parents to the table that might have otherwise breezed by, not wanting to look over jewelry with distracted children in tow. The $5 price point was also perfect as a simple purchase for kids, kind of a Goldilocks situation. Not too expensive, not too cheap, more just right. She sold all of her books that day, and also had one of her best days ever selling jewelry. The books may not have been a huge revenue stream. They definitely brought more visitors to her table. She ordered more books from the printer that year to use at all of her events, and also decided to write two seasonal books, one about pumpkins and harvests, the other about Christmas. She then began making gift baskets that included two of the books, say the original and the Christmas book, and adding in two ornaments while selling them for $20. Over 10 years, she said she sold about 5,000 copies of her books. There were 10 books in total at that time. That's a solid number of sales, but do the math. She makes about $3 per book. That's a rough number. The cut may be higher when she sells a gift basket, but she also gives some of the revenue to a friend that illustrated the books for her. End result, she's earned about $15,000 over 10 years. That's a nice amount, but not a life-altering $1,500 in revenue each year. 5,000 books sold, $15,000 earned. Not exactly enough to purchase a vacation home with a fancy car in the driveway. But here's the catch. She, and our first writer with his special edition binders, reacted to some unique situations and developed their own approaches to them. We may or may not consider those approaches true publishing. We may or may not think of them as printing. It doesn't matter. A writer wrote a story. He edited that story and printed it. He packaged it with a nice cover and presented it to people. He offers it for sale. A writer went to a friend and asked that friend to draw a few images to illustrate her story. She went to a print shop. Over the years, she's ordered thousands of copies of the book and sold them at shows and festivals and bazaars. If we set up a definition of publishing, both situations probably check off all, or at least the vast majority, of boxes to meet the definition of publishing. These are published writers. Keep that in mind as we set off to consider editors and agents, publishers and printers, tablets and smartphone apps and print on demand. The world of publishing is constantly undergoing change. That is especially true of the past 20 to 30 years, where the shift has been incredible and fascinating. It's going to change again tomorrow, and you need to be prepared for that. To start off, though, let's go back a few decades to what we might think of as a simpler time. Traditional publishing and self-publishing. Those are still the terms today, and overall, the two simplest classifications when it comes to writing and releasing our books. What do they mean? At the simplest and most basic of levels, the difference between the two involves who paid for the book to be printed. Yep, that's it. If it was a publishing house, traditional. If it was the author, self-published. The trick is, however nostalgic and romantic the notion, it's never been that simple. Traditional. Random House, Penguin, HarperCollins, Simon & Schuster. Those and so many others, great ones still operating today, and some gone to the pages of history. We know the names. Traditional publishing generally involves them and an agent. You send out proposals and queries, at times pitching to the publishing houses, but more likely pitching to an agent while seeking representation. Connections are made, contracts are signed, books are released. Self-publishing. When we go back over the decades, 50 or 60 years ago, it would be more accurate to call this self-printing. The use of this path usually meant that the proposals and queries failed. Now, that's a strong word, failed, because they may not have been bad at all. They simply could have been lost in a slush pile and never had a chance. But the reality is, the author had a manuscript, and no one expressed the desire to represent the author or publish the book, so the writer decided to take the rest of the project on. Almost every possible option back then involved finding a printer and paying to have the book printed. It both was and wasn't publishing, if you follow the train of thought. Not quite Schrödinger's manuscript, but we could probably turn that into a fun debate. For me, the transition between old-school publishing and the current environment begins to take shape in the mid-1980s when audiobooks establish a big place in the industry. Now, the history of audiobooks actually goes back almost 100 years, even more than that if you want to count Thomas Edison reciting Mary Had a Little Lamb. In roughly the 1930s, the American Foundation for the Blind worked with the Library of Congress and established a program called Talking Books. That's one of the starting points. By the 1970s, audiobooks had developed into specialized areas, such as instructional and marketing efforts. And then we arrive in 1985 and 1986, and the audiobooks craze for our personal listening takes off. Over about 10 years, roughly 1986 to 1995, the category goes from $200 million per year to more than $1.5 billion. While today we think of podcasts and streaming options for finding them, do not ignore the importance of audiobooks in the development of today's publishing landscape. For another idea, in the late 1980s and early 1990s, word processors arrived. Now, computers were certainly more than a novelty at that point, and word processors weren't exactly brand new. But computers came with a price tag, and word processors were a popular and cost-conscious alternative to buying a new typewriter when you couldn't afford a new computer. That said, most people I know do look past audiobooks and word processors and such, and they instead focus on the arrival of computers, email, and the internet in most households as the start of the seismic industry shift. And honestly, they have a good point. My ideas do create a start of new things, but not an earth-shattering start. By the mid to late 90s, packaging up a manuscript with a self-addressed and stamped envelope had pretty much been replaced by requests to send along an email with an attachment or to fill out an online form. These ideas, from a writer's point of view, absolutely redefined the publishing world, and they were computers, internet, and email at the foundation. The funny thing is, as we arrive in today's literary considerations, the changes really impacted traditional publishing and self-publishing in different ways. Now, first off, there are some similarities and topics that hit both segments. Electronic books would be a great example of this. There are overlaps and developments of importance and note striking somewhat equally. More to my point, however, the traditional publishing went to technology. If you'll allow me, traditional went digital as far as interactions between authors and the publishing houses. Agents, as an example, today almost exclusively request electronic proposals and queries. They do not want envelopes sent to their addresses. For the author, though, traditional is largely similar to what it has always been. Remember what I said? Random House, Penguin, HarperCollins, Simon & Schuster, and others, it generally involves them and an agent. Send out proposals and queries, most likely pitching to an agent as you seek representation. Connections are made, contracts are signed, books are released. All of this may mean different methods for moving from point A to point B to point wherever, but the same destinations and signage are available along the way. Self-publishing? Well, that has gone nuts, and there is no better example of that than the general thoughts associated with print-on-demand. Remember how I mentioned that decades ago it was all about who paid for the books to be printed? An author looking to self-publish might walk into a printer to talk about a project. It was almost certain they would be offered a deal if they ordered more copies. Print 100 copies for so much, 500 copies worked out for a bit less per book, 2,000 copies worked out for a bit less per book than that. A wonderful example of the more you buy, the more you save. Unfortunately, that didn't always mean more profit per book after all of them were sold, because for way more writers than not, all of them didn't sell. Ordering more books meant a bigger stack of boxes containing unsold books being stored in closets, basements, and garages. It meant a bigger loss. Enter print-on-demand. Technology has advanced to a point where the printing of a single book isn't hideously expensive. Get things lined up right, a person heads to a website and orders your book, and the reader essentially pays for the book to be printed, not the author. And that is a completely different business model. For our purposes right now, let's head back to the stories I shared. In upcoming episodes, we're going to explore dollars, markets, how bookstores and librarians view traditional and self-published books, agents, and more. But at the very start of it is us and the project, the author and the book. Three ring binder special collector's editions may not be my approach to things, but how about this? A writer puts together a science fiction or fantasy title and gets a booth appearing at a local or even a regional convention. One or two others join the writer. In addition to the books in a binder, they have a photo printer with them, and everyone has an assignment in the smooth process for their vendor location. A person comes up, buys the special edition, and not only gets the dated and numbered and personalized book, they also get a photo with the author, autographed and slid into a protective sleeve located just inside the front cover and before the book starts. That's actually a pretty cool idea. And our jeweler with the children's books? She has already developed her own marketing and process. A bigger publisher might not mean additional sales, and could even mean a reduced profit margin once all of the costs associated with the publishing house and an agent come into play. It doesn't mean it shouldn't be explored as an option. It just means that in this specific case, for her, she has found a niche that already works, and she's happy with how it coexists with and supports her jewelry sales. Traditional publishing and self-publishing remain the two overall categories, but there are additional branches on the tree these days and other considerations involved. Have things changed over the years? Yes, obviously, in massive ways. And then again, not so much. Let's take a moment to consider slush piles. A slush pile in the literary world is, in the most basic of definitions, a stack of unsolicited materials. These are the query letters, the book proposals, and the manuscripts we send in to publishing houses and agents for consideration. If they don't have the time to read them, they get put off to the side. Let's say you're an agent. You're good at your work and you have established a bit of a name for yourself in your office. Not so big that you have other agents that you work with. It's just you and maybe two or three assistants. Every day, 20, 50, 100 or more envelopes arrive at your office. Yes, arriving envelopes. Let's start old school for this example. You and your team don't have time to open all of them every day, so you find a table in a conference room or perhaps an unused desk, and you bring the unopened and unrequested packages to it and stack them up. There it is, your slush pile. As a good agent, you're spending a good deal of time putting together pitches and proposals on behalf of your clients. So often, you aren't the first one to touch these packages. One or two people from the office, when the more pressing work is done and the checklist of priorities allows for it, wander to the pile, pick something up from it, open it, and do an initial evaluation. Here's a side note. Have you ever wondered why some folks are telling you to get to the point and make your impact fast? This is why. A group of people in an agency have a pile already in place, with more envelopes arriving tomorrow. They do not have 4 hours to wade through your proposal and consider every nuance you're bringing up. You might have a few minutes, at best, to connect and make a good impression. If you do, your package gets read even further. Then it gets passed along to the next set of hands. Hopefully, eventually, it makes its way to a final decision maker. And by the way, side note to the side note, have you ever wondered why some writers say that luck plays a huge role in the process? Yeah, it's the same idea. You could send in the greatest book proposal of all time, and if the timing is wrong, it gets lost in the middle of the slush pile, and more envelopes are arriving to get placed on top, and, well, not your lucky day. I need to point out this is absolutely not, in any way, shape, or form, a criticism of the process, the agents, a group of agents or an agent's team. If we want them to give our work proper consideration, and we expect quality efforts and support from our agents, then we have to respect the work they do as professionals. For the most part, these are great people doing hard work in a thankless situation. Instead, I want you to view it from the perspective that not everything is ever going to be quick and immediate. It's just not possible for an agent to respond within hours to a proposal, and it isn't fair to think that if we, as writers and authors, are sending in poor quality material, that an agent has unlimited time and resources to clean things up and make it all better. Now, for those of you that think that the electronic age has wiped away the slush pile, I ask you to consider your own email accounts. Ever get something from a friend or family member and say something to yourself about getting back to it later? After a couple of days or more of additional mail arriving, that one you had great intentions of getting back to slides down in your inbox beneath newly arriving stuff. You're seeing it already, right? The slush pile developing in an email inbox, the potential of stuff getting shifted and lost. There's a cliche about how the more things change, the more they stay the same. We've all heard it. If we examine the publishing industry, a great deal of it is the same as it ever was. Large publishing houses and agents lead the parade of traditional publishing. Authors navigating the waters of self-publishing by leading the progress of their projects from idea to market on their own. And along the way, envelopes and phone calls and trips to the post office now involve emails and websites and social media accounts. At the heart of it all, it's still about relationships. It's about finding your place in the community. I'd like you to think of that community as involving two paths. And you know them already. Traditional publishing and self-publishing. When you look at it through the basic lens, you can see where a letter and stamp yesterday has become an email with an attachment today. Again, same process, different vehicle. There are publishers that focus on certain areas. Some want fiction and some want nonfiction. Some may focus on young adult or older-oriented materials, while some are working on things for children. There are agents that will specialize. Some only want nonfiction work. Some want fiction work. Some may take on only the book process, while others might be prepared to wander down the road with you into television and motion picture rights. And then there's print, electronic, and audio editions, sold in small bookstores, on giant websites, and using print on demand. The ways to break things down are, frankly, endless. So don't complicate it. Stick with the basics and build from there. You've been listening to Writing and Publishing with Dumb Old Bob. This podcast is brought to you by Parkside Backpack Productions in partnership with In My Backpack. To learn more about me, this podcast, and my writing, visit the In My Backpack site today at inmybackpack.com. I was assisted in the development of the podcast by Justin Gillen, Jay Gillen, and Karen Chappell. Justin is a phenomenal musician, and he wrote, played, and recorded all of the music we use on our podcasts. Jay is an extremely talented artist that has been delivering great work on projects with me for quite some time. In addition to all of his designs and efforts for Dumb Old Bob, he also created the iconic logo for In My Backpack. Karen is a creative, motivated, thoughtful woman that has been delivering countless exceptional technical results and ideas for our productions and has been a driving force in bringing our podcasts to reality. And while I would love to take all of the credit, the truth is, if you are enjoying the Dumb Old Bob podcasts, the talents and contributions of these three are playing a significant role in us being able to accomplish that. I invite you to send along your questions, suggestions, and comments. We have pages on several social media sites for Dumb Old Bob, and you can also reach us by sending along an email. Thanks for stopping in for this episode, and check in with us again soon. Backpackville, we're all friends here. Until the next time, have a great day.